This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Jewish Problem and Antisemitism. This is about the importance of identity and your point of view as to how you see the world. It's, from my point of view, it's a conflict of interest. The term antisemitism actually came up when I joined Carolyn Yeager and Haddink Scott last week on the Heretics Hour to celebrate our first birthday of the White Network. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit and tie it in with what I was talking about anyway, the Jewish problem. So let me get right into it. I know Carolyn is somewhat favorable toward the term in the fearless sense that she has about most things. She is anti-Jewish, as I am, and recognizes the Jewish problem as well as I do or better, and sees the term anti-Semitism as just being, you know, a fair description of that. And Haddink Scott made a point where he identified himself as a racist and as a National Socialist, but demurred on the anti-Semite label, because he said that that was defining himself as in opposition to something outside of himself, and that he didn't think that made sense. And at the time, that made sense to me, and it still does to a certain extent. But then again, to be a racist, to believe that race exists and to feel loyalty to a larger group outside yourself is something outside yourself. The real key difference, I guess, there between accepting an identity as a racist or as a racialist, somebody who believes that race exists, and being labeled as an anti-something, is the anti, is the negative aspect versus a positive aspect. That's my interpretation anyway of or my remarks on what Hadding had to say about it. I wanted to connect the dots now between Jewish identity and the Jewish problem and antisemitism, and say that, you know, based on what I covered in the last installment, that the Jewish problem, you can understand, is almost an equation. The Jewish problem equals Jewish identity plus Jewish power. When Jews who see themselves as a group, as a collective, get power, it becomes a problem for anybody who's not a Jew. And the Jewish problem, in a nutshell, as I concluded in the last installment, is how do we whites, as non-Jews, survive the infiltration by Jews, rule by Jews, and ultimately death by Jews? But even if you set aside race and you set aside the Jews and say, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with race, doesn't have anything to do with Jews, just being ruled by anyone who doesn't positively identify with you is bad for you, from your point of view. If the person who has control over your life doesn't feel favorably towards you and is instead hostile to you, that's going to be bad for you. It seems so clear to me, but you know, just to put it in terms here that separate out the Jewish aspect of it, or even the racial aspect of it, just in terms of identities, groups, groups of X's and Y's, you know, it's or A's and B's. It's easy to see what I'm trying to explain here. Now, the counter arguments that you sometimes hear really amount to excuses or apologetics, and the ones specifically made in favor of Jewish power and the Jewish problem is there's a couple. Jews don't actually rule, so it's sort of a denial that there is any, that Jews have any sort of power, that they actually do rule over anybody. But that's pretty ridiculous, and even Jews themselves discuss Jewish power openly. It's really only when somebody objects to it that they act as if that it's imaginary or that you're crazy for bringing it up. Another argument or counter-argument or excuse is that Jewish rule isn't bad. And first of all, that contradicts the denial that it even exists. Is, you know, once that doesn't work, they usually fall back to, well, okay, it exists, but it's not bad. There's nothing wrong with it, which is a kind of denial, too, because it denies that anybody could see it as bad. And that sort of blends into the next one, which is, well, you're the problem. If you think Jewish rule is bad, well, you're actually the problem. And I can see that. I can see that point of view is from the other side. Yeah, of course, anybody who objects to your rule over them is a problem for you as the ruler. So, but, you know, the disturbing thing about that, of course, is the language that they use and the way they try to portray it. They don't see it in a, you know, sort of an objective way like I just described. They see it more as an entirely one-sided thing, which is to their advantage because, you know, there's a certain strength that comes from absolutely rock-solid moral superiority and not listening to what pleadings your enemy makes, what arguments your enemy makes. It's just, it's difficult as a European, as a white man, to overcome my natural instinct for objectivity. Even though I can be biased in favor of my own people, and that is essential for whites to do that, I just have to admit that it's difficult for me to do it, and it's difficult, I understand, for whites who listen to this kind of a discussion to do it. So the point I want to make, the main point in this podcast, is that how are the Jewish problem and anti-Semitism related? They're pretty much the same thing. They're just two different views of the same thing. The Jewish problem is from a European point of view, from a white point of view, that Jews are a problem. Anti-Semitism is the label that Jews give it, and it's from a Jewish point of view, from a point of view sympathetic to Jews, is to call it anti-Semitism. Now, it wasn't always that way. The term has been used in the past in a way that was favorable, that Carolyn Jaeger is thinking of when she mentions it, especially in Germany in the mid-19th century. And I'll get to that a little later. But what's going on really here in these two sides of the same coin is a struggle. It's a race war. It's a stealthy race war, with Jews, for the most part, being the ones aggressing against whites. And the problem for whites is that Jewry is organized and winning, and whites aren't. Jews are, I mean, whites are disorganized or unorganized and losing. And a large portion, we can't forget, of the Jewish activism, of the Jewish organizing, is aimed at tracking and disabling any sort of white organization in our own favor, pathologizing, demonizing, suing, illegalizing, and so on. Now, I posted on my blog a few days ago a post specifically about anti-Semitism. It was titled Foxman and Sachs Explain Anti-Semitism. And this is two big Jews, Abraham Foxman, who's the head of the Anti-Defamation League, and so a big Jew in the United States and really in the world, very prominent, powerful. And Jonathan Sachs, who is the chief rabbi in Britain, pretty much the Abe Foxman figure in Britain, with the color of religion more on Sachs and less on Foxman. And I cited or linked and commented on four videos recently produced and released, and I won't review what I said there. You can go and read that blog post yourself. But what I wanted, the main point I wanted to bring out here is, from a Jewish point of view, what is anti-Semitism today, right now? And what these two Jews describe, what they have in common, is that they see anti-Semitism as an infection. It's a disease. And they use that kind of language. They call it serious infection, and it's viral, and it mutates, and it's completely inhuman, but biological description of what anti-Semitism is. It's kind of superficial. They don't get into the details. How is this disease spread, and what exactly causes it? That's incoherent, really, when you listen to what they have to say. It doesn't make all that much sense. Because, in fact, anti-Semitism is a reaction to Jewish power and Jewish influence. It's a conflict of interest between Jews and non-Jews. When Jews do what they do and what's best for Jews, it disturbs the people who they insist on living amongst. But that's not the Jewish telling of it. Now, I mentioned this viral disease aspect because, sometimes white people get very uncomfortable, as I mentioned in the last podcast, talking about things in that kind of plain language, using the phrase or the term parasitism and describing the Jews as a parasitical entity, as parasites, seems shocking in a way to your sensibilities. And part of that is because of indoctrination, because as I think I made the case pretty well, it fits. The description fits. And if these powerful Jews are willing to use this even less justified language about people like myself, and I have no doubt that either one of them would identify me as a horrible anti-Semite, I feel a lot more comfortable, actually, knowing it's really tit for tat here. I feel actually kind of like a slowpoke in not coming to this conclusion a lot sooner and not realizing that on my own, that without being a reaction to what they're saying and thinking, okay, well, I can do it because they do it. And I feel embarrassed actually about making that point, but I have to make it because there's truth in it. That why are we afraid to call these people parasites when they call us diseased? It's just another example of the asymmetric warfare going on here, where the Jews don't in any way really constrain themselves in how they wage war. They do it stealthily, but it's a no-holds-barred sort of attitude that they have. Whereas white people, even, I've been doing this, I've had these realizations about how things work pretty much down for 5 years now. And still, pieces continue to fall into place it's incredible to me. Well, anyway, what's mutating, really, ironically, is Jewish power. Jewish power is growing. And it makes it more difficult to disguise or explain away. It makes the explanations that Jews like Sachs and Foxman offer kind of impossible, really, to explain what anti-Semitism is. The environment is changing. The internet is the biggest recent change. It makes it possible for us to communicate with each other, no matter where we are, freely, without Jews interfering. Now, they're trying to change that. That's one of their big drives. What they're using their Jewish organizations to do is to lobby for the kind of discussion and monologue that I have going here and the discussion we have on the White Network as being hate and illegalized. It's anti-Semitism illegalized and preventing it in that way. And they're well aware of that, and they're openly trying to do that. They're openly conspiring to manipulate governments to do that for them. Let me move on here to another point. Anti-Semitism has a good entry at Metapedia. I was surprised, actually. It's a little bit choppy. It doesn't flow very well, the whole article, but there's lots of information in it that you won't find at Wikipedia. For instance, it claims that the term was invented in 1860. And this is different from what is claimed in the mainstream, that it was coined in 1879 by Wilhelm Marr. And even Jonathan Sachs refers to it indirectly. He doesn't mention Wilhelm Marr by name, but he lists that as stage three of the mutations of anti-Semitism, and which I should make the point here that anti-Semitism today is used by Jews and their friends to refer to all anti-Jewish, you know, to the Jewish problem basically throughout history is now labeled anti-Semitism in retrospect. The term wasn't coined until 1860, and Jews didn't see it as a problem until 1879, because initially it was coined in 1860 by a Jew who was referring to a contrast. A man named Ernest Renan had written a contrast of Semites and Indo-Europeans, of the two civilizations that were, and at the time, there's this confusion I've talked about in the past when I talked about Aryans and Indo-European, which is pretty much a synonym for Aryan, that it was a linguistic categorization at first, and Semitic was as well. And over time, science and archaeology pieced together that it was also an extension of a people too, that it had a racial dimension to it, that Indo-European had a racial dimension to it, and I presume Semite does as well. But anyway, that figures into it here, because what the Jew who used the phrase, the term anti-Semitism first, was criticizing was a racial point, that this Renan had made the point that the Indo-European civilizations, the civilizations of those peoples, surpassed at a certain point the Semitic civilizations. So that's what the Jew got upset about and called anti-Semitism. Now, in 1879, it was Wilhelm Marr that popularized the term anti-Semitism, because he formed an organization called the League of Anti-Semites, and he wore the label proudly as to denote his opposition to Jewry. In that article on Metapedia are several good quotes. The first one I'd like to quote directly is from Joe Sobran from 1992. An anti-Semite in actual usage is less often a man who hates Jews than a man certain Jews hate. The word expresses the emotional explosion that occurs in people who simply can't bear critical discourse about a sacred topic and who experience criticism as profanation and blasphemy. He's talking about the Jews. And, you know, what I don't like about this, even though it's one of the more recent quotes, it's the most recent in the article, what I notice is this trend of really getting more and more circumspect, more and more vague in opposition to Jewry as time goes on. The closer we get to now, the more suppressed, the more couched the terms of people resisting anti-Semitism. Here, what Sabrun's point is that, very similar to my point of view point, which is that anti-Semite has become someone the Jews hate, not what the Jews claim is that it's somebody that hates Jews. And Sabrun's just pointing out that it's more often it's the Jews, the one applying the label. People don't wear the label anti-Semite. Not very many do proudly attach that label to themselves anymore because they recognize the pain and stigma that comes with it. Another quote from 1925, and this was attributed to Count Cherub Spiridovich. Are we going to let our world be destroyed so as not to offend a tiny number of people who accuse us of anti-Semitism to cover up the crimes they are committing against us? That is a brilliant way of putting it. I agree wholeheartedly with that expression. But that was in 1925. That was probably at the peak of white racial awareness, not only of the white race, but of race in general, and the Jewish problem, the problem that Jews posed to European kind. And this count, who I had never heard of before, expressed it in exactly the terms that I did in my last podcast at the end, the conclusion I made, and what I have just introduced in this podcast. So I'm somewhat gratified by that. I don't ever have the illusion, really, that I'm the first person to realize anything in what I'm realizing. But it's always pleasing to find that somebody else has looked at the same thing and described it in the same way. It's partly why I do these podcasts, so that other people who have been thinking about these things may hear something that strikes a chord with them in what I say, what I point out to them that other people have said. Now, about Wilhelm Marr, let's focus on him more directly here in the last few minutes of this podcast, and I guess I'll have to extend this into a part two. Wilhelm Marr is cited, at the very least, if he didn't coin the term, as the popularizer of the term anti-Semitism. And the strange thing about him is he had a predilection for Jewish women. He was married four times. The first two women were full-blown Jews, Jewesses. The third was mixed, and the fourth wasn't Jewish, according to Wikipedia anyway. And their Metapedia mentions that it's possible that Marr himself was Jewish, a renegade Jew, according to the Jews. But whether he's Jewish or not, I think what's interesting is that he's identified so strongly as a key figure in anti-Semitism. Now, Kevin MacDonald posted a key paper of Marr's titled The Victory of Judaism Over Germanism, Viewed from a Non-Religious Point of View. And this was published in 2010, the translation to English. About 135 years it took to be translated into English. Now, maybe there were some translations in the past, but they've been lost, apparently, until 2010 or so. And it first appeared in 1879, this pamphlet of Marr's. The foreword by the translator who did the translation, who was neutral in his translation. Previously, it was mainly Jewish historians and Jewish commentators describing Marr and what he had to say. And this, I thought that this translation was pretty honest, and you can see it in the foreword that's written by the translator. He says that today, Marr is considered one of the most important exponents of modern anti-Semitism. And just how important he is described or related by a Jewish historian, he says, who wrote a book that called Marr the Patriarch of Antisemitism. Now, I have to say, when I read the essay, the pamphlet, I was disappointed. Because after that buildup, you expect to find something really insightful. And to a certain extent, it is insightful. But what's disappointing about it is it comes across as pro-Jew. It comes across as anti-German and defeatist, ultimately. It's right in the title there, that the victory of Judaism over Germanism. And the sad thing about this is that it wasn't written down in private diaries that were later published. He published this intentionally for public consumption. So you have to wonder what he was trying to do. Now, Marr claims in his own writing that he wasn't trying to be ironic. He was trying to just simply acknowledge the facts of Jewish power and Jewish victory. Now, a way of seeing what Marr's pamphlet was and how it was received, I guess, at the time. Well, I don't know about how it was received at the time, but the parallel I see is with an event that just happened last week or 2 weeks ago, when Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, commented on Jewish power and influence and how wonderful it was, how enormous their power and influence was, but how wonderful it was. And what Wilhelm Marr did was he basically went on beyond Joe Biden territory. He talked about Jewish power and influence as being all-powerful, but also basically conquering. What he didn't do, where he went beyond Biden, was that he recognized that Jews and Germans were distinct. And that's a no-no from the Jewish point of view. Although the Jews arrogate for themselves that they are always, of course, separate and, in fact, above anyone else. If anyone else recognizes themselves as distinct, or even in Marr's case, as distinct and subordinate to the Jews, that is something that the Jews absolutely cannot stand. That's anti-Semitism. You can't recognize the simple fact of Jewish power, according to the Jews. At least not and say it's a bad thing. So I've run out of time for this installment, but let me conclude by saying and reiterating once again how the Jewish problem is related to anti-Semitism. The Jewish problem is, it means the Jews are a problem from a white point of view, whereas anti-Semitism means whites are a problem or non-Jews are a problem from a Jewish point of view. Do I call myself an anti-Semite? No, I don't. I call myself a white man. I identify as white. I'm physically healthy. I'm mentally healthy. I recognize Jewish rule. I also recognize the genocidal consequences of that Jewish rule on whites. And I speak against it.